Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Earlier this year, Chemours decided it would keep its headquarters in Delaware with help from a nearly $8 million state incentive package.
You know, there was a lot of competition for us, and I would say the state of Delaware did a fantastic job putting a package together. And as we look at it, we really like to be in Delaware, and we like to be in Wilmington.
We go one-on-one with Chemours CEO Mark Vergnano about the company's health and its future in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Nationwide, medical and recreational marijuana advocates are uneasy about what a Trump administration might mean for their industry. We examine how it could affect Delaware. We also learn more about the Delaware Botanical Gardens coming to Sussex County and dig into the history of Return Day in this month's History Matters. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Things are looking up for Chemours. The Wilmington-based chemical company recently enjoyed its best quarter since spinning off from DuPont a little over a year ago, announcing a $204 million profit in its third quarter earnings report last month. It also beat analyst expectations in a number of areas, among them its third quarter earnings per share of 61 cents, which beat analyst forecasts by 30 cents per share. It's the kind of earnings report that has some saying Chemours has turned a corner in its efforts to stand on its own. We recently had an opportunity to chat with Chemours president and CEO, Mark Vergnano, about the company's health and other issues. We started with his outlook following that third quarter report. The company's recent third quarter report was very positive. It's best since spinning off from DuPont a little over a year ago. It does have some saying Chemours perhaps has turned a corner. Do you feel that way?
You know, I do, Tom. If you think about it, you know, we started life in July of 2015, and, you know, we touted ourselves as a startup with a 200-year history, if you will, or a 200-year head start. And, you know, our start was a little bit rocky, and that's why we put in place something we called our five-point transformation plan, which is really how to transform the company from a good company to a great company. And from that standpoint, you know, what you saw in the last quarter results were really a reflection of us executing off of that transformation plan. You know, really, as I've said to many people, hitting on all cylinders of that transformation plan, whether it's, you know, the cost reductions we have, the growth delivery we had in our key products like Opteon, rebalancing of the portfolio, all that really is right on track of where we want to be with the end point for us being the end of 2017.
And I do want to hit on a couple of those products you mentioned. Opteon was one of them. The sales also for titanium dioxide is also strong in that third quarter. But I do want to focus on Opteon. It's a relatively new product, seems to be gaining traction quickly. I imagine this is precisely the type of product that can put you on a positive trajectory going forward based on its initial interest and results.
Yeah, so Opteon is, as you said, it's a really, really interesting product in that, you know, our parent DuPont really invented this whole fluorochemical refrigerant category. And if you look back over the many, many years this was in play, it really replaced ammonia. And so that is sort of the legacy that we have inside of the R&D inside Chemours. So Opteon is the first refrigerant, if you will, that'll be used that has very low global warming potential. All refrigerants now have zero ozone depletion, but the problem with a lot of the refrigerants that are out there today is they have very high global warming potential. So Opteon is one of two products out in the marketplace that really have very, very low global warming potential, which is required in Europe now for every vehicle starting in 2017. So it's a huge market opportunity for us, and at the same time really helps the environment at the same time.
And that seems to be where things are going in terms of trying to find these products that have the same usefulness and efficiency with less of the you know, negative implications. I mean, and we see, as you say, it seems like in Europe it's already taken hold, and perhaps as some of these other efforts in climate change take shape, these type of products would be things that people are really interested in.
No, you're right. You know, either because, like in Europe, they're being regulated, or what we found is we're seeing Opteon being picked up here in the U.S. with customers like Trane or Johnson Controls, where they're putting the product inside of their commercial air conditioning equipment because they're trying to market themselves as being greener companies. So it actually helps them in terms of how they're interfacing with their marketplace. So it can be driven by regulation, which we'll see over the next 5 to 7 years. You'll see that across the world as the world is trying to drive to better and cleaner types of chemicals. Or it could be driven by, you know, market preference, consumer preference, where people are looking for better environmental products, better performing environmental products.
I wanted to also ask you a little bit more about another piece of that five-point transformation plan, specifically the reducing expenses piece of it. And in the third quarter, I think it was $60 million you realized in reduced expenses. Has that particular piece of the plan, the expense reduction, gone better than expected at this point?
I'd say it's right on track.
Okay.
You know, when we came out with the plan, what we said is we were going to reduce our costs by $350 million from the end point of 2015 through the end of 2017. And then, you know, in our first 6 months, we took out $100 million. This year, we'll take out almost $200 million, with the remainder going next year. So, you know, from that standpoint, you know, we're right on track to be able to deliver that. And so, yes, there was $60 million in the quarter, but that was all planned. And these cost reductions are, you know, we put them into three categories. You know, the initial piece of that was people-related, which is very difficult to do. The second piece has been more facilities-related in terms of, you know, how do you consolidate offices and labs and plant sites. And then the third piece of this has been around procurement. And, you know, what we found is that we can buy smarter. You know, we're not a tiny company, but we're a lot smaller than the company we came from.
Sure.
You know, we're a $6 billion revenue company. But that's still big enough to have a really good purchasing power. But what we've realized is, as a simpler company, which is one of our values, you know, we don't need as much as perhaps we did in the past. So all three of those components, almost a third, are contributing to the $350 million. So right on track for where we want to be by the end of 2017.
And you mentioned that end of 2017 piece of it. As that approaches now and you say you're on track, are you approaching the point where you start looking to pivot from that transformation plan to what's next for Chemours going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom, because from that standpoint, you know, this is where you want to – we absolutely want to pivot to growth, and that's something that we're already starting to plan on. But – at the same time, I'm trying to keep a very diligent focus on delivering what we promised in our transformation plan that we will do by the end of 17. But, you know, our investors already are asking, listen, as you are successful in your transformation, what's next? And that's the work we're doing now because, you know, we really want to be a significant chemical company, chemistry company, if you will, in the world. We have the world's leading position in TiO2, the largest position in TiO2. We have the world's largest position and most profitable fluoroproducts business. We have the largest sodium cyanide business, which goes to gold mining. So we have three very, very great pillars to build off of. So we are really thinking about what are the areas for us to grow into even beyond that. So you're exactly right. We're starting that work because you have to have a head start before you really are able to implement that. But in the meantime, we have not been shy at investing in these businesses. You know, we just finished our largest investment in our TiO2 production with our new plant down in Altamira, Mexico. We announced and are in the midst of building our new Opteon facility where we will come on board in 2018 with three times the capacity that's being built in Corpus Christi, Texas. So we are not shy about where we're putting our investments in these businesses as we're going forward, but we think we will pivot to even higher growth as we come out of 17.
I do have to ask, is there much of a concern with Chemours' possible exposure in the ongoing DuPont C8 litigation in terms of knocking you off track or maybe delaying your ability to make that pivot to looking forward?
You know, that's something that we have always had in our thought process. You know, as I had mentioned to many in the past, you know, as we exited DuPont and really became our own company, we came with some issues that we had to deal with. We had high debt. We have some environmental liabilities. We have some legal liabilities. But we came with some tremendous assets as well. We have a fantastic workforce that is experienced, is knowledgeable, and has high energy. As I mentioned, we have three businesses that are number one in the world. So, you know, we really start with some really good strengths. So we've been working, playing off of our strengths as the investments I talked to you about, and at the same time trying to minimize the downside. And, you know, we've reduced our net debt by $1 billion. So the debt piece of that is getting handled. And as we get stronger and stronger and stronger, and our balance sheet now is very strong, you know, you can withstand some of the issues that the litigation might proposed to itself in the future. So this is all part of our transformation plan. Being a stronger company allows you to deal with some setbacks when they do happen.
So you've kind of baked that into the plan going forward, the possibility of that being a force that's puts pressure on you.
Yeah, it's part of who we are, you know, and it's part of what we inherited from the very beginning. So yes.
That's Chemours President and CEO Mark Vergnano. We'll have more of my conversation with him, focusing on the company's future in the First State, in just a moment. So stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last segment, we brought you part one of our interview with Chemours President and CEO Mark Vergnano, focusing on the Wilmington-based chemical company's health and future after its strong third-quarter earnings report. This segment, we continue our conversation with Vergnano, delving into Chemours' future in the First State. In 2015, the company closed its Edgemoor plant in North Wilmington and trimmed its local workforce, raising questions if it planned to stay in Delaware. But in August, Chemours announced it will keep its headquarters right here. Part two of our interview with Vergnano starts with a discussion about that decision. Let's turn to Chemours here in the First State. You announced in August you'd be keeping the company headquarters in Delaware. The state did approve nearly $8 million in incentives for Chemours if it keeps 900 jobs here through 2020. Within the spectrum of factors that went into making that decision to stay in the First State, how crucial was that package and some of the other changes the state has made recently, such as the Delaware Competes Act, to keeping the company here?
You know, I think those were critical. I mean, we had some choices. You know, one of the choices we made up front was because we were being wooed by a lot of states. But we have, as you mentioned, 700 here in Wilmington, but just about 1,000 people in Delaware that are employed within Chemours. And uprooting all those families and uprooting our experience level didn't seem to make a lot of sense. So we decided we wanted to be close by to be able to accommodate our employees the best way we possibly could. So, you know, there was a lot of competition for us, and I would say the state of Delaware did a fantastic job putting a package together, you know, from Governor Markell to at the time Representative Carney to both the senators. I think everyone really, really tried to help us find an opportunity. And as we look at it, we really like to be in Delaware and we like to be in Wilmington. You know, when we look at it from that standpoint, you know, Wilmington is really a great location for our world headquarters. It makes sense for our workforce, but it also is great access to talent. You know, talent that we have today, but talent that we want to attract. And, you know, as we looked at it, being in an urban setting, you know, especially a city that is really trying hard to be better, I think is going to be a good attraction point for talent that we bring into Chemours, because it's a place that, especially the millennials that we hire, really like to have that urban setting. They like to be able to walk out the door and pick a place to have lunch instead of, you know, the company cafeteria. They don't want to be in a suburban mall kind of atmosphere. I think they like the energy that a city brings. And, you know, as Wilmington is becoming more and more vibrant, I think we're going to be a good addition to the city landscape from that standpoint.
There were some lawmakers and others who questioned the effectiveness of some of these incentive packages. Most recently, they pointed to Bloom Energy, which is not hitting promised job creation benchmarks as one example. What do you say to those who are skeptical about these incentive packages and Chemours' commitment to keeping those nearly 1,000 jobs through 2020 and its commitment to Delaware beyond that, essentially that this is a good long-term investment of state dollars?
Yeah, I do think it is a really good investment. And, you know, I look at the Delaware Competes Act and, you know, up until that point, Delaware was not competitive. And if you just look at the states that just border us, it wasn't competitive with the states that bordered us. And that was going to be a problem. And I think I give the governor a lot of credit. Governor Markell took that on himself with the support of his legislature and used this as a point. It wasn't done for Chemours. It was done to how do you attract companies into Delaware and make it a positive instead of trying to overcome a negative. And I think the Delaware Competes Act did that just really, really well because it put things on equal footing with the states around us. And now you allow the state to compete on what you want it to compete on, talent. You want it to be able to compete on access to government officials. You want it to be able to compete on where can I bring in the smartest folks to build our company. And I think it puts the state on really good footing to be able to do that.
And it sounds like you're pretty bullish on Wilmington. Right now you're in the DuPont building. The News Journal recently reported that you might be interested in moving to the Bank of America building. But first of all, is that a possibility moving out of the DuPont building? And I guess larger, is Wilmington a place you feel really comfortable with as a headquarters for Chemours?
So to start with the last piece, Tom, yes, we're comfortable with Wilmington being the headquarters. We did a lot of thinking about this. And as I mentioned, having an urban setting, we believe is going to attract the workforce that we want to attract for the future of Chemours. So that was right off the bat, once we decided Wilmington was the place for us, you know, and what we wanted to do with our workforce, it just made sense. Now it's just a matter of where. You know, we do own the DuPont building, so we're here today. The choice for us is really going to come down to, you know, renovating this building to be a modern workspace for our employees so they feel good about where they work and we have a much more productive workspace. You know, this is a 100-year-old building that we're sitting in today that really hasn't been renovated for 100 years. So it needs some work. Or choices around other places here in Wilmington, and there is space available for ourselves. So we're going to make the best decision for Chemours. Either way, it's going to be a good decision for Wilmington. And a good decision for our employees.
But ideally, you'd like to stay within the city limits, not looking outside the city limits to maybe a more suburban type of spot.
Yeah, and we've made that commitment.
Okay.
We really believe being in the city is going to give us the advantages that I mentioned around really attracting the workforce that we want.
Just last week, it was announced you're selling the closed Edgemore plant in North Wilmington to the Port of Wilmington and Diamond State Port Authority for $10 million. The company had said when it closed the plant that you were going to work with local officials to find the right opportunity to move that property forward. This would appear to be a pretty good outcome in that effort, correct?
I think so. I think it's a, you know, it's a great piece of land. It's a great location. It served us well for many, many, many years. And I believe it's going to serve the port and the city of Wilmington extremely well going forward. And, you know, this is sort of another proof point from our standpoint. We like to say that what we say we really mean and what we say we execute off of. And, you know, when we made the very tough decision to shut down our Edgemore facility, we told all the state officials that we will work day and night with them and with others to make that a viable location that will create commerce. And I think this will do that. I think this is going to be a great thing for the port and a great thing for the city of Wilmington and the state of Delaware.
Was there significant interest in that site beyond the port folks?
There actually was. You know, if you think about it, it's a very unique location in that it does have deep water attached to it. It's right on a rail spur, and it comes right off of 495. So from a logistical location, it was a very, very popular spot. So there were multiple opportunities to develop that land, and we received very quickly a lot of interest from that, and we just felt that the interest from the Port Authority made the most sense, not only for us, but probably made the most sense for the area.
Well, was remediation of that site much of a factor in trying to find the right person, the right person to sell it to?
You know, that site was well remediated. You know, we had done that all along, so there wasn't a lot to do there. I'd say the significant effort there was taking down the steel that was on the site. But in the remediation piece had already been done. It had been taken care of and handled all along by DuPont, and then when Chemours took that over as we spun, we had done just some final things there. But remediation was never really a big issue there.
Our thanks to Chemours President and CEO Mark Vergnano for his time this week. Up next, President-elect Donald Trump's choice for Attorney General, Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, is on the record as a staunch opponent of marijuana legalization. We look at what that could mean locally, including its impact on medical marijuana. Stay with us for that. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Nearly 6 years after Governor Jack Markell signed a bill legalizing medical marijuana in Delaware, the state is close to opening a dispensary in all three of its counties. But with Donald Trump set to enter the White House in January, some are concerned about what he and his pick for Attorney General could signal for the growing industry. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson reports on how first-aid businesses and patients are preparing.
The same election that ensured Republican control over the presidency and both chambers of Congress also saw the doubling of states to legalize recreational marijuana. 8 states now allow adults to buy the drug without a prescription, and 28 of them have legalized pot for medical use. President-elect Donald Trump himself has openly supported medical marijuana, but Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who Trump says he'll nominate to be his attorney general, is no friend of the industry. Here he is speaking during a Senate committee hearing earlier this year.
We need grown-ups in charge in Washington to say marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized. It ought not to be minimized, that it's in fact a very real danger.
Despite marijuana's growing legal and cultural acceptance state by state, it's still illegal under federal law with no accepted medical use. The Obama administration reined in enforcement during his second term, allowing states to create their own regulations, but those steps could be overruled come January.
Quite honestly, I think it's ludicrous that a federal lawmaker would have the possible ability to alter my current medical care plan, a plan that's been established by my doctor and approved by my state.
That's 34-year-old Laura Layfield Scherer, who lives in Wilmington. She's had a medical marijuana card in Delaware since February to help treat her gastroparesis, a stomach condition that blocks digestion, leading to lots of nausea and vomiting. Scherer says any plan to dismantle these programs would be met with fierce opposition from patients whose lives have been dramatically improved by a drug that's been stigmatized for decades.
Nobody would even think about removing insulin from the market.
But experts and dispensary owners don't think the situation is that dire. Sam Mendez, who runs University of Washington Law School's Cannabis Law and Policy Project, says it would be a Herculean task for Sessions to try busting up the current system.
Well, legally, they could certainly shut it down. Practically, it would be far more difficult, and it would take a huge amount of political will that I don't think the federal government has.
Mendez says it's more likely the Justice Department would roll back current orders that help block dispensary raids and those that tried to assure banks they wouldn't break the law by setting up business accounts for pot shops. Both dispensary owners that will oversee Delaware's three storefronts didn't want to share their contingency plans in case of a complete crackdown. Columbia Care will open Kent County's dispensary in Milford late next year. Its CEO, Nicholas Vita, says he's not especially worried about the incoming administration.
It's difficult to predict these things, and I think that, you know, we're cautiously optimistic that the value and the positive impact that these medically focused programs have brought to the communities, not just from a healthcare perspective, but from an economic perspective, will be recognized.
First State Compassion Center President Mark Lally agrees. He says his business just outside of Wilmington has grown 900% since they opened 18 months ago, and they still plan on launching their Sussex County store early next year.
I think we should at least give them the opportunity that he won't allow his personal beliefs about this industry to enter into any decisions concerning the job of the Attorney General.
Still, this wouldn't be the first time Delaware bowed to federal pressure when it comes to medical marijuana. When state lawmakers approved its use in 2011, Governor Jack Markell almost immediately halted progress on the program over mixed messages from the feds saying they could arrest state workers for implementing it. State public health officials declined an interview request for this story, but they said they will continue operating barring changes made at the federal level. Until then, patients looking for relief from medical marijuana or states like Delaware that are debating fully legalizing the drug will have to live with this latest uncertainty in a fledgling industry. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And The Green continues in a moment with this month's History Matters, which examines the history of a uniquely Delaware tradition, Return Day. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Return Day is a uniquely Delaware tradition, a political party of sorts that takes place 2 days after Election Day every 2 years, where political rivals bury the hatchet, both figuratively and literally. It's been going strong for over 150 years. Even as far back as 1888 in J. Thomas Scharf's History of Delaware, Return Day was called, quote, one of the customs peculiar to the people of Sussex from time immemorial, holding a high carnival on the day when the results of the election are announced, unquote. In this month's History Matters, produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society, Megan Pauley spoke with some of the people involved in Return Day, and those who've also dug into its history.
Just a few days after this year's Return Day, I met Rosalie Walls at the Georgetown Historical Society to tour their collection of wagons and buggies in the Marvel Carriage Museum.
And this is the dog closet where they would put the hunting dogs in there when they went on a fox hunt. And that's why it's so high, so they could see the fox running through the field.
Walls is describing one of around 25 carriages in their collection, which also includes a surrey with the fringe on top, a spreader that would have been ordered from a Sears Roebuck catalog, and even one that originally belonged to Walt Disney. The museum is named after Mr. Nutter Marvel, a local businessman who made his fortune in the oil and gas business. Nutter purchased over 100 of these buggies to honor the Delawareans who would have used similar modes of transportation to make their way to Georgetown for Return Day in its early years.
They were driving 15, 20 miles walking or riding horses or oxen or carriages to get here. They would actually be staying camping overnight or staying with friends or staying at local hotels.
That's James Bowden, 7th generation Sussex County resident and president of the Georgetown Historical Society. He's also vice president of Return Day and has researched the event's history for years.
Starting in the early days of elections here in Sussex County, the people would return to Georgetown or return to the county seat to actually vote. You return to Georgetown to hear the returns of the election.
for the office of President of the United States of America, Hillary Clinton, 39,329. Donald J. Trump, 62,607.
That's right, during the 1800s and early 1900s, residents had to travel long distances to the county seat to cast their vote. But Georgetown, Delaware wasn't always the county seat. It was in Lewis until 1791, when the seat was moved to Georgetown to provide a more centrally located destination for travelers.
And so Georgetown was known as 16 miles from anywhere. That's not quite the truth, but it's close.
And that backstory lives on in the name of a brewery just down the road from the Georgetown Historical Society, 16 Mile Brewing. And beer, or libations, as Bowden likes to say, were a big part of Return Day in its early days, too. Early hotels like the Eagle Hotel from 1802 and area taverns would welcome guests while they waited for the election results to come in, which took a couple of days.
They were quite a noisy crowd by the time the Return Day was over.
It was also a sort of seasonal celebration that travelers could afford to make, since it was just after harvest time. Bowden says it's one of the oldest agrarian, agriculture-related celebrations in the country. But as time passed and technology progressed, it wasn't always necessary to physically travel to Georgetown to vote.
Back into the 20s and maybe 30s, it was starting to go out of vogue a little bit because people didn't have to come. You had to telephone, you had to telegraph. They were actually seeing what the elections were at home, maybe in the 30s over the radio.
Despite the inconvenience of making a trip to Georgetown, the tradition continued, that is, until World War II.
Tires, guns, trucks, food, fuel, clothing.
Didn't want to stop their celebration, but they didn't want to stop the war production years either and take up precious metals and commodities that should be for the war efforts.
Bowden says the festival wasn't held for several years, but returned in 1948 thanks to Mr. Nutter Marvel. From that point on, since buggies were out of vogue for everyday travelers, Marvel's collection of carriages was used to carry politicians, both winners and losers, in the Return Day Parade.
We require the people that are campaigning against each other to come together in the carriage and sit in the same carriage as they're going through the parade. Now, the tradition is the winner of the election for that particular part of the election faces forward and the loser faces backwards.
Marvel himself led the parade for many years, and when he couldn't ride a horse easily anymore, he'd ride wagons through the historically Republican tradition of Return Day.
And if the Democrats won, they would be the only ones to show up. And they would throw a big party with roasting an ox on the circle and giving out free sandwiches. Conversely, the Republicans, if they won, they would be the ones to show up. And what they would do is they would have a grand parade.
But today, the traditions have merged and are part of every Return Day, regardless of which party wins. And in addition to the parade and party, a ceremonial hatchet is buried in some sand to symbolize a civil end to the election season. Rosalie Walls has been involved with Return Day since 1972, serving as the event's president for many years. She finally stepped away last year, but remembers a call she received her first year on the job.
Someone came in, now this is Wednesday, the day before Return Day, and they came in and they said, hey, you better call the fire company because the ox roast stand is on fire. Well, you know, being new in this position, I said, oh yeah, sure, right. I thought they were just kidding. And they said, no, we're serious. Look out the door. So I went over to the door and looked, and they were not kidding. The whole, it's like a little open, it looked sort of like a pavilion, only smaller. But see, they had these actually steer on spits, and the roof was aluminum, like tin. And of course, the fire was so hot that tin was actually melting and it was dripping down on the beef.
Thankfully, everyone was okay, and other years have been much less dramatic. And while Bowden's research hasn't pinned down exactly when Return Day started, He believes it dates back to as early as the 1790s. He has been able to confirm other stories that until now were simply hearsay. One of his favorites involves Charles Stokely, a farmer and political Democrat who served as Delaware's governor from 1883 to 1887.
He was elected governor, and his grand parade consisted of a boat he actually had taken out of the water and brought to the circle, and they paraded that boat around the circle while he was on top of the boat showing that he was now the governor of the great state of Delaware.
And despite the drama elections can cause both locally and nationally, Bowden says Return Day is a time for everyone, from both the Democratic and Republican parties, to come back together.
And we can talk. And we find that a lot of the politicians, even when they have a really tough election and they're really not talking to each other during the election, and sometimes slinging mud at each other, they will sit down and actually be cordial. And that's what the democracy is all about. And that's what we're proud of.
Seeing those connections in the works is Mrs. Wall's favorite part of Return Day.
You get to know all of the politicians from the lowest row office right up to the, you know, the senators and representatives that travel to D.C. And where else but little old Delaware would you be able to know them get to know them very close. They become friends. Most of them become long-lasting friendships.
Vice President Joe Biden has been to many a Return Day, even helping the event receive national historical recognition. And until Return Day is held again in 2018, the hatchet will remain buried in sand from the first Sussex County seat of Lewis, Delaware. Bowden said he's not exactly sure how old the sand is, but they don't replace it every year.
It's the sand that has been passed on over the years. We seem to not lose any, so that's great.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Polly.
Thanks, Megan. And a reminder, each month's History Matters is produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society. And we finish out this week's screen next with the latest edition of Enlighten Me, where we'll learn about a new public garden project getting off the ground in Sussex County. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Ground has been broken on a new public garden years in the making in Sussex County. At just over 37 acres, the Delaware Botanic Gardens will be the only space of its kind in southern Delaware. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart talked to the garden's vice president, Ray Sander, who says he's looking forward to the first flowers blooming.
What is the Botanic Garden exactly?
The Botanic Garden is a public garden being built here on the Delmarva Peninsula. It will be the first public garden in Delmarva, and it has been an interesting project in the sense that it is being developed by a group of citizens who've come together, recognized the need for a public garden here. You know, we have so many wonderful public gardens and botanical gardens in the northern part of our state. You know, the gold standard of botanical gardens, Longwood and others like Winterthur and Mount Juba Center, are just fantastic. But for people at this end of the Delmarva Peninsula, it's a 2 or 3 hour drive. And we thought we needed to have something that was more accessible for education, for children, and for families who wouldn't want to have to take that long trek. It's a public garden that's going to be celebrating the coastal plains horticulture, so it won't replicate any of the wonderful gardens upstate. It'll be really dedicated to the native plants and the horticulture of the coastal plain.
And this Delaware Botanic Garden has been in the works for years, right?
We started approximately 4 years ago. We were able to get access to 37.5 acres of very interesting land in right outside of Dagsboro. In Sussex County. The land was owned by the Sussex County Land Trust. They had put it aside as open space, and when they heard about our project, they said, we have a great space for you. And they rent it to us for $1 a year. We have a 99-year lease, and we can renew it for two more times. So we have for almost 300 years for $1 a year. And many new gardens spend the first 10 years of their existence raising money to buy the property, when in fact we were able to get it for $1. And so the money that we're raising is money that's going into the actual building of the garden and planting of the garden. So we're very fortunate to have this great relationship with the Sussex County Land Trust.
So tell us about the 10-year plan that the Botanic Garden has.
We started off with a homegrown site plan, and in the course of the last 12 months, the history and the direction and the vision of the Botanical Garden has been significantly raised. We were able last year about this time to secure a $750,000 grant from the Longwood Foundation. And so we now have the hardcore of our money to start the project. We still have to raise money to finish the project, but we have enough money to start the project. But in the course of the year, we also secured the services of Piet Aldoff, the very famous Dutch garden designer who's done gardens like the High Line in New York City, the Lurie Gardens in Chicago, the Botanical Gardens in Barcelona, the Royal Gardens in London. He came to Sussex. He saw the property. He loved it. And we gave him 2.5 acres to develop one of his iconic meadow gardens. And he's already given us his plan for that. And so we have that ready to start planting in the next planting season. So the opening gardens will be the woodlands and Pete Aldoff's meadows, and trying to highlight the waterfront and the views and the different horticultural opportunities the waterfront affords us. And it's given us a vision for a 10-year program, but we hope to be opening up in 2018 with these two smaller, these two features of the woodland and the peat meadow. And that will start our educational programs on site and special events on site and have visitors.
So you mentioned some of the great gardens up north in the state of Delaware, like Winterthur. And Winterthur offers outdoor and indoor garden segments. Is that a direction you're going to want to go with the Botanic Gardens, having buildings and outdoor space to intertwine?
Well, most of it's going to be outdoor space. We honestly have been, we don't have access to a lot of private money. And so what we're doing is we're doing it with donations, and foundations have been very generous. And we've been trying to hopefully, once we start our visitorships, be able to develop a revenue stream there that will enable us to offer a full range of programs. The only major building that we expect to be building in the next 5 years will be the visitor center, and that will have some indoor space for display, but mostly it's going to be outdoors. And so it's going to depend on the summer, the spring, and the fall, and maybe some winter events around the building. We're not going to have a conservatory. We're not going to have those kinds of major indoor facilities that some of the premier gardens have.
So you have some seed money. You are doing a groundbreaking relatively soon. And then you have plans to be open within 2 years, and then a 10-year plan beyond that. What do you guys hope to see maybe in the next 20, 30 years?
Certainly would be the development of the uplands, the remaining 25 acres with some other gardens. Right now, starting a project on a raw piece of land requires a lot of infrastructure, bringing in the water and the electricity and getting it landscaped in a way that accepts parking and the like. And so it takes a lot of unsexy stuff that has to be done in order to make a project sustainable and usable to the public. And so that's where we're spending a chunk of the money right now. But we're also trying to include, obviously, the planting of Pete's Meadow and the planting of the Woodland Gardens.
Our thanks to Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart and Delaware Botanic Gardens Vice President Ray Sander for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at delawarepublic.org. just head to the Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out the Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, and Megan Pauley, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.